Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today on our Capitol Report, we bring you highlights of fired FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, along with analysis and reactions. Next, hear about rent subsidies that the County of San Diego is offering for landlords to help the homeless. Then we'll have some local reaction from a Chaldean leader here to news about the horrific events unfolding in Mosul, Iraq, as coalition forces attempt to drive out ISIS. Highway 78 will be closed for the next 10 days. Be sure to listen for details. If you like counting sheep and you don't mind the heat, hear how you can volunteer for the annual Bighorn Sheep Count in the Anza Borrego Desert State Park. And then on Destination East County, hear about the most fun festivals and events coming up, from outdoor concerts and parades to Father's Day and 4th of July festivities. Our newsmaker interview today is with El Cajon Councilman Steve Goebel, who will be talking about some big changes happening in El Cajon and a proposal that aims to help older homeless people get off the streets. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. In riveting testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday, fired FBI Director James Comey confirmed that President Donald Trump did ask him in person and in phone calls to back off the investigation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's Russian ties. Trump fired Comey after he refused to back off the investigation or swear a loyalty oath, promising honesty instead, Comey attested. In his opening statement, Comey described his interactions with the president, and he takes issue with the president's negative characterization of the FBI, at one point calling the president of the United States a liar. Here are Comey's opening remarks.
When I was appointed FBI director in 2013, I understood that I served at the pleasure of the president. Even though I was appointed to a 10-year term, which Congress created in order to underscore the importance of the FBI being outside of politics and independent, I understood that I could be fired by a president for any reason or for no reason at all. And on May the 9th, when I learned that I had been fired, for that reason, I immediately came home as a private citizen. But then the explanations, the shifting explanations, confused me and increasingly concerned me. They confused me because the president and I had had multiple conversations about my job, both before and after he took office. And he had repeatedly told me I was doing a great job and he hoped I would stay. And I had repeatedly assured him that I did intend to stay and serve out the remaining 6 years of my term. He told me repeatedly that he had talked to lots of people about me, including our current attorney general, and had learned that I was doing a great job and that I was extremely well-liked by the FBI workforce. So it confused me when I saw on television the president saying that he actually fired me because of the Russia investigation, and learned again from the media that he was telling privately other parties that my firing had relieved great pressure on the Russia investigation. I was also confused by the initial explanation that was offered publicly, that I was fired because of the decisions I had made during the election year. That didn't make sense to me for a whole bunch of reasons, including the time and all the water that had gone under the bridge since those hard decisions that had to be made. That didn't make any sense to me. And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. And I am so sorry that the FBI workforce had to hear them, and I'm so sorry that the American people were told them. I worked every day at the FBI to help make that great organization better. And I say help because I did nothing alone at the FBI. There are no indispensable people at the FBI. The organization's great strength is that its values and abilities run deep and wide. The FBI will be fine without me. The FBI's mission will be relentlessly pursued by its people, and that mission is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution of the United States. I will deeply miss being part of that mission, but this organization and its mission will go on long beyond me and long beyond any particular administration. I have a message before I close for my former colleagues of the FBI, but first I want the American people to know this truth. The FBI is honest. The FBI is strong. And the FBI is and always will be independent. And now to my former colleagues, if I may. I am so sorry that I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to you properly. It was the honor of my life to serve beside you, to be part of the FBI family, and I will miss it for the rest of my life. Thank you for standing watch. Thank you for doing so much good for this country. Do that good as long as ever you can.
Acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe has backed Comey in his recent testimony before the Senate committee, stating, Director Comey enjoyed broad support within the FBI and still does to this day. And he added that the Russia probe is significant. Now, after his opening statement, Comey fielded questions from senators on both sides of the aisle. Comey confirmed that Russia's attempts to hack and influence the U.S. election were very real and widespread. He testified that Russia targeted hundreds of targets, perhaps over 1,000, for cyber intrusion in the U.S., including massive spear phishing campaigns in an effort to disrupt the election. Now, there were many questions asked that Comey said he could only answer in a private session, not a public session, due to the classified nature of the material. He did say he saw no evidence that election outcomes were actually changed. However, as my own past national award-winning investigative reporting on this topic has demonstrated, on certain voting systems, hacks can be impossible to detect after the fact due to software programmed to actually erase vote-flipping evidence, and many of those paperless, flawed voting machines are still in use in some swing states. Comey, however, also confirmed that he did tell Trump that he was not personally under investigation at the time, though Comey refused pressure from Trump to state this publicly because the probe could lead to investigation of the president directly later on, and Comey wished to avoid having to issue a correction should that occur. Comey also indicated that Trump's conduct fell within the scope of the FBI's investigation. Comey, who has worked for both Republican President George Bush and Democratic President Barack Obama, said he never felt a need to take notes after meetings with them, but did with Trump because he believed Trump might lie about what transpired, he told the committee. Comey also revealed that he arranged to leak his memos to the media in hopes that it would result in the appointment of a special prosecutor. He also said he has turned over all of his memos to newly appointed special prosecutor Robert Mueller. Former FBI Director Comey further attested that he asked Attorney General Jeff Sessions to intervene and stop any further private meetings with the president, which he believed were inappropriate. He wanted to prevent efforts by Trump to try and suppress the investigation, but he said Sessions did not comply with that request. His testimony also raised questions about whether Sessions has fully stayed out of the investigation after recusing himself, since Sessions was untruthful in his own Senate confirmation hearing about past meetings with a Russian official. Now, Trump had earlier indicated he would be live-tweeting responses to Comey's testimony, but he did not do that. Instead, Trump's personal attorney, Mark Kawitz, did issue a statement afterwards affirming that Comey, quote, confirmed publicly what he repeatedly told the president privately. The president was not under investigation as part of any probe into Russian interference. A day later, Trump did send a tweet, however, blasting Comey as a leaker for arranging to have copies of his memos provided to media. Comey also had some criticism of a New York Times report that he said inaccurately alleged intelligence documenting collusion between multiple Trump campaign operatives in Russia. While it remains for the investigation to determine whether any Trump campaign representatives knew of or colluded with Russia to hack or influence the election outcome, Comey did make clear there is no fuzz here, in his words, on the clarity of proof that Russia did make hundreds of aggressive efforts to electronically tamper with the election. What's not clear is why the President of the United States has continued to denounce all reports on Russian election hacking efforts as fake news, instead of showing serious concern to investigate the Russian tampering efforts and prevent such hacks in the future. Trump's attorney said the president has flatly denied asking for a loyalty pledge, and he faulted Comey for leaking memos to the press, claiming these were privileged information, although Comey asserts his own personal memos, made on his own computer, were his property and contained no privileged material. Reactions to the intense testimony varied sharply. Republican Chairman Richard Burr peppered Comey with questions over whether he had any doubts the Russians were behind cyber intrusion into state voter files and a break-in at the Democratic headquarters, the cyber version of Watergate, and if the Russian government was fully aware of these actions. Comey stated he had no doubts that all of these things are true. Chairman Burr also asked if it's possible that criminality, collusion, and coordination with Russians on non-election issues might become part of the investigation, and Comey said this is possible. Burr also questioned Comey on his handling of the Clinton email investigation. House Speaker Paul Ryan, a Republican, suggested later that since the president is new to government, perhaps he simply just didn't know that a separation should be maintained between the president, the Justice Department, and the FBI to avoid the appearance of obstructing justice. That argument, however, is weakened by Trump's own past criticism of Obama's Attorney General Loretta Lynch, who spoke briefly with ex-President Bill Clinton at an airport during the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Trump apparently understood then that private meetings between federal investigators and those who may be involved in their investigations should be avoided, along with any appearance of a conflict of interest or pressure to sway or drop an investigation. Obstruction of justice was among the articles of impeachment drafted to remove President Richard Nixon, who resigned to avoid impeachment. The Senate Intelligence Committee's vice chair, Mark Warner, a Democrat, called Comey's firing shocking. He questioned why Trump has shown an unexplained affection for Russian dictator Vladimir Putin and voiced dismay at Trump referring to Comey in a meeting with Russians as a nut job, while telling the Russians that Comey's firing took great pressure off the president in his dealings with Russia. Warner concluded, "This is not a witch hunt. This is not fake news. It is an effort to protect our country from a new threat that, quite honestly, will not go away anytime soon."
If you're a landlord looking for tenants, San Diego County is offering bonuses of up to $500 if you'll rent to a homeless family, veteran, or other homeless person with a rental assistance subsidy from the Housing Authority. The county needs help to house over 150 people with subsidies, but who are having a hard time finding a home. Todd Henderson, Director of County Housing and Community Development Services, says, "We are offering landlords incentives to make it easier for them to rent to people looking for safe and stable housing. The region's low vacancy rates create substantial barriers for people experiencing homelessness," Henderson added. "Landlords can receive $500 for the first unit that they rent to a person or family with a rental assistance subsidy from the county, and up to $250 for each additional unit leased under the program. A landlord can also receive up to 2 months rent security deposit and or utility assistance, up to $5,000 in damage claim reimbursement, application expenses, and holding fees. A full-time landlord liaison through the county is assigned to make sure everything runs smoothly. Landlords interested in participating in the incentive program should call 211 San Diego. Finding homeless people a stable place to live is part of the county's Live Well San Diego vision for a healthy, safe, and thriving region. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Coming up next, the Chaldean Corner on East County Magazine's radio show, bringing you news for and about our region's Iraqi Chaldean community.
Iraqi forces, backed by the United States, are driving Islamic State or ISIS forces from the stronghold of Mosul, where the terrorists have held civilians captive for 3 years. But the toll is bloody and brutal. CNN reports that ISIS killed over 160 civilians in a single day this week, while aerial photographs reveal horrific carnage. A UNICEF press release issued June 5th warns children are being killed, injured, and used as human shields. Children are experiencing and witnessing terrible violence that no human being should ever witness. In some cases, they have been forced to participate in the fighting and the violence. An estimated 100,000 girls and boys remain in extremely dangerous conditions in Mosul. UNICEF estimates even hospitals and schools have reportedly been attacked by ISIS. UNICEF is responding to the urgent protection needs of vulnerable children and families who are fleeing the conflict, including family reunifications and emergency psychosocial support for distressed children. The Guardian newspaper reports that civilian deaths from U.S.-led strikes on ISIS have surged under the Trump administration. 60% of all civilian deaths in the three-year campaign against ISIS have occurred in the first 3 months of this year, with larger bombs reportedly being deployed by coalition forces. Mark Arabo is president of the Minority Humanitarian Foundation in San Diego, which is home to over 60,000 Iraqi immigrants. Arabo states in a press release, "The killing of over 160 innocent civilians illuminates the desperation of ISIS in their effort to maintain Mosul. Our thoughts and prayers go to the innocent civilians murdered by ISIS in cold blood." Arabo notes that the murdered civilians were not combatants, but were simply trying to flee the terror in Mosul. He calls on the world to take action, stating, "We, as a global community, must stand for innocent civilians and facilitate any attempt they may make to flee." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Rebecca Williamson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement from Caltrans. State Route 78 will be closed for 10 days between Weekend Villa Road to Indian Oak Road, between Escondido and Ramona, starting on Friday, June 9th at 6 a.m. through Monday, June 19th. This closure is necessary so that crews can build a retaining wall to stabilize the slope on the north side of the highway where rock slides recently occurred. Closure is subject to changes based on weather conditions. Caltrans had originally planned the closure in mid-May, but postponed it to avoid impacting traffic for the Ramona Rodeo. Detours will extend from Cloverdale Road, San Pasquale Road area to Main Street and State Route 67 in Ramona, though access for locals will still be available. Expect traffic delays if you are traveling in these areas.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The Anza Borrego Foundation is looking for volunteers to help count sheep. No, not the kind you count when you go to sleep. The fourth annual Anza Borrego Bighorn Sheep Count is set for June 29th through July 1st. The count helps document populations of endangered peninsular bighorn sheep locally. There are only about 500 bighorn sheep left in the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, and an estimated 900 in the entire peninsular desert bighorn range. It also provides amazing opportunities to view and photograph these elusive desert denizens for volunteers willing to brave triple-digit heat and participate in the annual sheep count. The count is done in summer when it's easiest to find bighorn gathering at waterholes. This year's bighorn sheep count will go on despite the death of the event's longtime leader, Ranger Steve Beer. A letter from Anza Borrego Desert State Park Superintendent Kathy Dice and Sheep Count Coordinator Mark Jorgensen, who are organizing a new sheep counting team, advises, "We were unable to find the master sheep count mailing list." So they're organizing a new sheep counting team. If you would like to participate, or if you know of people who participated in the count in the past, you're asked to please send contact information to ab.sheepcount@parks.ca.gov. That's ab.sheepcount@parks.ca.gov. In addition to volunteer sheep counters, backpackers and four-wheel drive vehicles are also needed to help get volunteers into some remote sites for the count. There is a mandatory orientation on June 17th for all new counters. That's also recommended for past sheep count volunteers. For more information and applications to join this year's Bighorn Sheep Count on June 29th, June 30th, or July 1st, you can visit the Anza Borrego Foundation's webpage at theabf.org. That's theabf.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes Lavender Day at Summers Pass Farms, the Julian Dance, the Taste of La Mesa, Fido Fest in Santee, outdoor concerts in La Mesa and Santee, and night fishing at Santee Lakes.
Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions, including a Father's Day adventure at Fort Cross in Julian, the Julian Blues Fest, a Passport Through Time road trip on historic Highway 67, a Father's Day brunch with Cowboy Jack, Santee Salutes, Julian's 4th of July parade, and El Cajon's Independence Day celebration.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Summers Pass Farm in Flint Springs invites you to Lavender Day, which also includes an antique and craft fair on Saturday, June 10th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can celebrate the fragrance and beauty of lavender, shop for lavender plants and lavender-scented gifts, and find over 40 craftsmen and expert artisans offering crafts, collectibles, and a garden sale. Jim Earp will provide live music. For details, you can visit summerspastfarms.com.
Sons of the American Legion will present the 11th Annual Julian Dance on June 10th from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. The Backcountry Dance and Barbecue features music by Three Chord Justice and the California Rangers, a large dance floor, plus dinner slow-cooked Santa Maria style over open oak wood flames. Foods and wines and beers are available for purchase. The event is described as a throwback to a simpler time with twinkling lights and bonfires, a time for mountain residents and visitors to get together for a great time. To listen to the bands or to get tickets, you can visit juliandance.org.
The City of Santee will be hosting Fido Fest on June 10th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., along with Camp Bow Wow. Fido Fest will be held at Town Center Community Park East. You can adopt a dog, enter a dog owner look-alike contest, enjoy live entertainment, get discounts on vaccinations, microchipping, and dog licenses, and bid on silent auction prizes to benefit Dogs on Deployment, which helps deployed military members find volunteers to board their pets. For more information, visit the City of Santee's website.
La Mesa's Summertime Sundays at Six Concerts season begins June 11th and will be held each Sunday at 6 p.m. at Harry Griffin Park. Opening night will feature the San Diego Concert Band on June 11th. Music styles over the season include show tunes, country, bluegrass, jazz, blues, disco, classic rock, and horn tunes of the 70s. For more information, visit lamesaparks.org.
The La Mesa Chamber of Commerce invites you to enjoy tastings from dozens of local restaurants, caterers, pubs, and more at the 9th Annual Taste of La Mesa, Monday, June 12th, from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the La Mesa Community Center. Savor options such as gourmet sausages, Himalayan cuisine, farm-fresh foods, beer, and other beverages. For all the delicious details, you can visit lamesachamber.com.
You're invited to come drop a line during night fishing at Santee Lakes on Thursday, June 15th, from 5 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. For details, visit santeelakes.com.
Santee kicks off its summer concert series with the Cadillacs on June 15th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Town Center Park East. This event also features a classic car show, kids' activities, and picnic-style seating, as well as food trucks.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
Fort Cross in Julian invites you to bring Dad for a Father's Day adventure on June 17th that includes rugged, manly, fun things like a tomahawk throwing competition, archery contest, and paintball slingshot area. The family can also enjoy a petting zoo, sunset hayride, dinner, and playing jug band instruments around a campfire. You can spend the day or even camp overnight. You can reserve tickets for dear old dad and the whole family at fortcross.com.
The 19th Annual Julian Blues Festival is set for June 17th at Mangini Winery. This year's lineup includes Philip Stacey, Dennis Jones, Earl Thomas, Ben Robinson, and the McCoy Brothers. Tickets are also available at rob-bauerpresents.com.
You're invited to join in a fun drive to discover the unveiling of historic Highway 67 in San Diego's East County on June 17th from 8:30 to 1 p.m. Travel through the wild and scenic countryside, stopping at pit stops in El Cajon, Santee, Lakeside, and Ramona. This event is presented by the Historic Highway 80 Corporation, along with the Santee, Lakeside, Ramona, and San Diego East County Chambers of Commerce. For information and reservations, you can visit eastcountychamber.org.
Pine Hills Lodge will host a Father's Day brunch on Sunday, June 18th. Cowboy Jack will sing traditional country music from Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, and more, also playing acoustic guitar and harmonica. For reservations and details, visit pinehillslodge.com.
Santee Lakes invites you to watch The Secret Life of Pets on an outdoor movie screen on Friday, June 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. There's more before the movie. Wild Wonders will do a presentation, plus meet and greet with 6 animal ambassadors from all over the world. Find directions to the lakes at santeelakes.com.
Julian proudly proclaims its annual 4th of July parade to be the best small-town parade in America. The parade starts with the firing of a cannon and also includes earlier flyovers by vintage aircraft, a gunfight and bank robbery staged by the Julian Doves and Desperados from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. The parade itself starts at noon and includes equestrians, marching bands, floats, and more. For full details, visit julianparade.com.
The City of El Cajon invites you to celebrate Independence Day with numerous games, live musical entertainment, and fireworks at the City of El Cajon's 4th of July celebration. On July 4th, the El Cajon Recreation Department will host the event at Kennedy Park. From 1 p.m. to 8 p.m., you can enjoy carnival games, an inflatable, a kiddie train, and skate park. Free crafts and family games will be available from 2 to 6 p.m., with music by 2 live bands from 3 to 9 p.m. A fireworks show with synchronized music at 9 p.m. will provide a finale.
The City of Santee invites you to celebrate Independence Day at Santee Salutes, held on July 4th from 2:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Town Center Community Park East. Visitors can rock out with live music, see a patriotic ceremony, enjoy a kids' fun zone, and a spectacular fireworks display at 9 p.m.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is El Cajon's new councilman, Steve Goebel. Steve, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
Now, Steve was raised in El Cajon. He's a franchise executive, and he's been a small business owner, so he brings a lot of business management expertise to the job. And he's been really involved in some important things happening on the council. Steve, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about why you ran for the council and what a couple of your biggest goals are that you hope to accomplish?
Sure. As a longtime resident of El Cajon, I love El Cajon. And so the reason why I ran is because I love El Cajon. It's just that simple. And One of the things I wanted to do was to make the community a better place to improve the quality of life for the people and the businesses here.
Very good. Well, I'm sure that's a goal that everyone can get behind. So there's been a lot happening in El Cajon. Let's talk about a couple of the real positive things going on first. We've seen a lot of economic development that's bearing fruit. You just ran an editorial for us about that on East County Magazine. Can you give our listeners a couple of the highlights?
Yes, we've got some exciting new things coming to the city. The Courtyard Marriott is about ready to open in August.
Mm-hmm.
Already coming before the Planning Commission is the next hotel, the Hampton Inn at the site of the old police station.
Really?
And that's coming up, I believe, on June 20th for the Planning Commission. So we're perhaps less than 2 years away from a second hotel opening.
Very exciting. And, of course, we've also seen new revenues coming into the city, particularly from the car dealerships such as Mercedes-Benz and BMW that the city has actively gone out and worked to attract. And that brings in more sales tax revenues that can be used for the benefit of the people of El Cajon. Now, another new thing that's very exciting, I'm personally very excited about, is seeing the East County Performing Arts Center about to reopen. What's going on with that? Last we heard, the city was entering into negotiations with Live Nation. Tell us about that.
Sure, Marian. Live Nation is the world's largest concert promoter, and they just have top management, top acts that they can to draw to this city. We're trying to still work out a contract with them for them to manage the facility, but they could bring just some great acts to El Cajon, acts that are up and coming, who mm-hmm. are opening for A-listers now.
Great.
There would be cultural concerts, and then what we call the sunset performers. They've had a famous career already, but there's still some people that love to hear them, and so that would be a third class of popular acts that could come to El Cajon.
Fabulous. Will there also be opportunities for community theater groups or community organizations to use the theater on the days that Live Nation is not booking acts?
Absolutely. And that would be, to me, a very important yeah. part of a community
it
performing
is.
Arts center.
I still have fond memories when my daughter was just a little girl. They put Tech Ice out there on the stage during the Traditions of Christmas performance, and it happened, they needed a skater that was little enough who could land double jumps on that small space, so she got the job, so to speak, and it was just such a wonderful community-oriented place, but also, a lot of people don't realize it had, at least at the time, it was considered to be the finest acoustics of any theater in San Diego County, better than the Civic Theater where the symphony was performing back then, and so it's just wonderful to see that you finally got the roof repaired, some of the ADA upgrades and things going on, and hopefully Live Nation coming in soon. When will we know about that?
We might have something back for the council to listen to perhaps this summer, later this summer.
Very good. And what is the expected reopening date?
Well, the best case scenario probably is quarter three of next year, because we would still need to make additional improvements to the Arts Center to bring it up to Live Nation standards. But I agree, this is a facility that is fond of a lot of memories for a lot of people.
Yeah, it really is. There's been a lot of great things happening in El Cajon, but there's also been some issues that are ongoing. Like any city, it has its share of problems too. Probably the biggest problem that we hear complaints about from folks through the years is the homeless population. It's not unique to El Cajon. Rising homelessness is a problem nationwide.
Well, the county of San Diego is fourth nationwide in terms of number of homeless, but 27th in terms of funding for the homeless.
Yeah, so that's a real disconnect there. And within the county, El Cajon has the highest population in East County. Let's start by asking, Steve, why do you think that El Cajon tends to have more homeless people than, say, Santee or Lemon Grove or Spring Valley or some of the other outlying areas?
There might be three magnets for homeless in El Cajon. One would be the transit system. It's very easy to get to El Cajon and get around El Cajon.
Mm-hmm.
The second would be the recycling centers. The different number of recycling centers can be a magnet.
Sure, because homeless people often collect cans and bottles as their only source of income.
As their only source of income, you're right. The third issue is that the city of El Cajon is home to many county services, social services, for people who need assistance.
Okay. And of course, also, it's actually a very affordable community compared to much of San Diego. So I would imagine, too, that if somebody is already in maybe affordable housing because they're fairly low income and then they lose their job, they may not have that cushion that somebody out in La Jolla or Rancho Santa Fe might have to help them, and they may be even more at risk of becoming homeless, possibly.
They are, and the myth is that people are being bused in or brought in from other parts of the county into East County, but the sources that I'm hearing, the police, Crisis House, Regional Task Force on the Homeless, say anywhere from 70 to 80% of the homeless in East County are from East County.
Now, you've really done your research, I understand. Tell us a little bit about some of the studying up that you've done on the homeless issue.
Well, this was something that was important to me even in the campaign season, was how can we try to tackle this program? And so I kind of went on a listening tour to listen to different mm-hmm. people. What do you have to say? All the different stakeholders, the police department, perhaps up to 30% of their time is spent on issues related to the homeless.
Yeah.
The fire department, taking them to emergency services in the hospital. That's a cost.
Which drives up our healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm. I listened to the Regional Task Force on the Homeless. I participated in the East County Chamber's Homeless Task Force. I listened to the people at Crisis House. I listened to people who are homeless advocates for downtown and others. And putting all these thoughts together, really, they said, we need a housing navigator.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about the housing navigator in just a moment. But first, I'd like to provide a little bit of background on things that the city of El Cajon has already done in the past for the homeless. I think it's fair to say that while some have criticized the city for maybe not doing enough for everyone, they've actually done a lot more than the cities of Santee or La Mesa or Lemon Grove or what the county's done for folks in the unincorporated areas. Basically, those other areas, if you're homeless, you're pretty well expected to get yourself to either downtown San Diego or El Cajon for some help. El Cajon has done a lot of funding of the East County
Transitional Living Center.
Of the East County Transitional Living Center. And that's kind of a two-pronged program. There is, it's run by some religious folks, but there is a non-religious component, which is what the city has given money for. It offers some short-term housing to get people, especially families and things, off of the streets. So it's a very good thing they're doing. And then they have longer-term programs to provide job training and stuff, but you have to sort of, you know, be a part of their church activities to participate in that, as I understand it, and that's not funded by the city. The main criticism has come from folks who think there should be more done on a secular basis for everybody who maybe isn't of that particular faith. But now you've come forward with a program called Housing Navigator, part of something called Project Home Team. So tell us what that's all about, Steve.
Sure. Project Home Team is kind of a complement to the existing services that are already out there. Mm-hmm. As I listen to the people who work with homeless people every day, there is a path that is necessary and needed for emergency shelter now housing. Perhaps victims of domestic violence, they need a place to stay tonight.
Right.
The transitional living centers offer a long-term treatment plan for other people. Mm-hmm. But then this other path that Project Home Team addresses, those that are just ready for a home. And I called it Project Home Team because, number one, we're trying to find a home for people. That's the home and home team.
Yeah, it sounds so basic, but the biggest problem with homelessness is simply people don't have a home. It's awfully hard to go out. You know, people say, well, get a job, but it's kind of hard to get a job when you don't have an address to send, to have, you know, the employer contact you at, or you don't have a phone, or you don't have access to a shower or a way to keep your clothing clean even. I mean, it's very, every little thing seems a lot more challenging if you're living on the streets.
That's true. And streets can be living in a canyon. It could be living in a car. It's someplace that's unsheltered.
Right, exactly. So how does the Housing Navigator program work?
Well, Project Home Team is proposing a two-pronged approach. Number one, before the council is a request for $150,000.
And when will that be on the agenda?
I'm hoping it's June 13th, but we have a budget upcoming here to talk about, so we'll see what the workload is in terms of agenda items.
Okay.
But it takes money, and it funds a housing navigator through Crisis House here in El Cajon. And it also provides money for temporary rental assistance for those that don't otherwise get funded through other sources, such as victims of domestic violence or veterans or mentally ill. So this program is going to start with seniors age 55 and over.
Wonderful. I know so many seniors who really have just been on the edge, very nearly homeless themselves. Typical case is the rent goes up or their medication costs go up in some cases, and all of a sudden they're having to choose between, do I pay my rent? Do I pay my medication? I have one friend who sold her car just to pay her rent and take medication. So it's easy to see how somebody can slip into homelessness when they're a senior, when it's harder to find jobs, if not impossible, when you're not quite old enough to qualify for Medicare yet, and yet medical costs are maybe a very large portion of your budget. So this would take people between 50 and 65, and how would it help them?
Miriam, that's a great point. When you're age 55 or older and you're homeless, it's harder to get a job. That's just the reality in today's world. And so what Project Home Team does is it partners with St. Paul's Senior Services. They have a program called PACE, Program for the All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly.
Very good.
And it addresses, or it helps seniors age 55 and over who are at risk of needing nursing home care, who are eligible for Medicare, but they have to have a home. They have to be housed.
So when you say eligible for nursing home care, that means these have to be folks that have some sort of medical condition that's debilitating, for example?
Yes, they're at risk because of their current condition. It could be physical or mental.
Yeah, so it certainly seems like that's a good place to start. If you don't have the funds to help everybody, at least help the ones who would be most at risk by being on the streets. And I've always thought it kind of ironic that it seems like there's funding. If you're a drug addict by choice, you can get help if you want it. There's rehab mm-hmm. programs for you, stuff like that. And yet if you're a senior who's simply down on your luck and having major medical problems, there doesn't seem to be a program for you if you're under 65. So now there is.
Now there is. And that's good news.
Yeah.
That's really good news.
Now you mentioned it will also include people with mental illnesses. How does that work?
So also part of Project Home Team is working with the county under their Project One for All. That works with people who have been designated as seriously mentally ill. And Crisis House here in El Cajon is a place that has the counselors, the trained, the qualified people to make that designation.
Okay. Yeah, I know we, just today in my email box, I heard from people who were posting on one of our local online forums from El Cajon, and they were complaining about what they described as a crazy woman who's sort of living on the streets out there, and she's been cursing at people and throwing chicken bones at passerbys and sort of things. It's a really difficult problem, isn't it, with the mentally ill, because how do you address it if a person maybe isn't willing to accept help? What do you do?
That's a very difficult problem. You're right. And the spectrum of a mental illness runs the gamut from people who are probably near independence to those that really need total care, in a sense. And so it's probably very situational. I'm told, after listening to these people, that the county jail system is the number one provider of mental health care in San Diego County.
That's sad, isn't it?
It is sad that you have to be incarcerated in some cases to get mental health.
Wow.
But you work with what you have.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it's one way to do it. But it seems like it's not the best way, and hopefully there'll be more solutions come forward. Now, what about for people who are homeless in El Cajon, but they're under age 50? Is there anything else in the pipeline that you can envision to help younger folks? I'm thinking in particular when we have very young people who are on the streets who could be vulnerable. Let's say they're maybe runaways or they've been thrown out of their house for some reason, but who could be at risk of human trafficking, which is an enormous problem in our area. Is there any kind of help or outreach existing or in the pipeline to help folks like that?
There isn't that I'm aware of. There are different programs. If you're, as you mentioned earlier, a victim of domestic violence, if you have mm-hmm. substance abuse, if you have mental illness, if you're a veteran, and this program works with seniors, but if you don't mm-hmm. fit those categories, what's there for you?
Yeah.
It's not a crime to be homeless. It is a crime to do things.
Yeah. Well, some cities have tried to make it a crime, picking up people for vagrancy. Basically, there's cities that have made it illegal to park your car overnight in parks or any public place, and they arrest people simply for sleeping on the street, even if the shelters are full and there's nowhere else for them to go. So I think it's positive that El Cajon is at least looking to try to help these people instead of just kicking them out. I know there's certain other places in East County where they simply encourage the homeless to go somewhere else. And that's really just kicking the can down the road, I think, and not acknowledging that there's problems in some of those communities, too. So at least El Cajon is to be commended for doing something. I would be remiss also without mentioning that the other new councilman, Ben Colasso, also had a proposal. His idea for the homeless was to have the city hire 20 homeless people and then also pick up some of the shopping carts and things to discourage the ones that didn't want jobs or whatever. But, of course, there's a lot more homeless people than there would be jobs available. And I understand that that idea was not approved by the council. Steve, can you tell us what the concerns were and why the council didn't approve it? Was it just a matter of not wanting to spend the money on 20 jobs, or were there some other underlying issues?
Well, there are several concerns that I have with that proposal. Number one is when you become on the city payroll, now you are eligible for health benefits, retirement benefits. Mm-hmm. You also have to talk about what if that person hurts somebody in the course of doing an employment? Is the city liable? What if that person gets hurt? Now we have potentially a workers' compensation issue. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the costs started to add up, and I don't, even then when you give these 20 people money, there's no guarantee that they're going to use it on housing to become housed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And also I've heard that there were concerns that, of course, many of the city's jobs are unionized. The workers are unionized, and so you can't just bring in a non-union worker if it's a unionized workforce in a particular division. So there's that issue as well.
That very well could be.
Yeah, interesting. What else do you see coming down the road for the homeless? Is there anything we haven't mentioned already?
Well, the Project Home Team really is a pilot program, and the goal is to find housing for 25 people. We're asking for a program cost of $150,000. So if we're able to house 25 people, and the police department have told me they know names of individuals that want to get off the street because Great. They're in contact with them frequently.
Great. So they already have a list of people that they think actually would be helped by this.
Absolutely. And to get a person into a home is good. It $150,000 divided by 25 people into homes is a cost of $6,000 to get somebody into a home where the county and other funding takes over. I think we can save $6,000 just in emergency response costs for some of these people.
Very good. And of course, every dollar saved on that is dollars that can be put back into the community, into other things such as the Wonderful America on Main Street event you just had, the dinner and the concert, some of the things the city helps fund, along with your merchant groups and things, to help benefit the entire community. I was really impressed at the last El Cajon Council meeting where they were talking about the America on Main Street that they held, the diversity of all the faces there and the smiling kids, and trying to really give back and help the community. El Cajon is a city that has changed demographically more than any other in our region, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the last decade or so, it's gone from being very blighted, a lot of buildings that were boarded up and down Main Street. It's also changed demographically. It used to be largely white, largely conservative, largely a sort of a Western heritage that everybody was mm-hmm. very proud of. And there's certainly still that pride and that heritage.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've seen now is the city is now a majority minority. And it isn't only the ethnic minorities, but it's people from around the world that have come there through the refugee programs and immigrant programs. You've got a huge Iraqi Chaldean population. There are Muslim populations. There are many Latinos there. You know, just people from around the world. So, I mean, what do you think about all of that? All of the changes that are going on in El Cajon from when you grew up? You've certainly seen it all. And we're in kind of an era where we see an awful lot of immigrant bashing, so to speak. But what do you think the impact of the immigrants has been on El Cajon?
Well, it's definitely changed the face of El Cajon. You see different signs in different languages.
Mm-hmm.
I think and it has changed since when I grew up here. I think what we have to do is try to find some way to unify the community, put more unity in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes everybody. That includes immigrants becoming Americans.
Yeah.
And it becomes Americans welcoming immigrants.
You had the naturalization ceremony at the America on Main Street, along with multi-ethnic entertainment and food and everything that was really kind of nice to see.
You're right. There were 100 people naturalized that day from 54 countries.
54 countries. That's amazing. It's becoming like City Heights in a way, where they speak, I think, more languages in City Heights than any other community in America. And yet there is some strength in that. You know, like anything else, when a lot of people come in who are newcomers, some people complain about it. They don't like to see signs in different languages. And yet, Main Street's not boarded up anymore. There's a lot of thriving businesses, and I think it's probably safe to say that most of them were founded or owned by some of these immigrants and newcomers who've come in. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. You're very correct. A lot of the people who came from other parts of the world are several of the ones who have opened up, boarded up businesses on Main Street. And so we have to value and appreciate and include and absorb all of that into our culture without losing the heritage and the color and flavor of old El Cajon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, really, unless you're Native American, all of us came from somewhere else, even the pioneers on the wagon trains that came through here in the early days, or the Spanish that came here. You know, we're all children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of immigrants from someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Steve, I'm going to let you have the final word today. What else would you like our listeners to know about yourself or about what's happening in El Cajon and this vision of renewal that seems to be taking place out there?
You know, the great thing about El Cajon is we're on the move right now. For many years, it was just kind of stagnant. And I think the city manager has just had a great vision for developing business. The two new hotels, and we're actually hearing from more hotels now who are interested because there's two already in the pipeline.
Interesting.
These could be the first, well, they will be the first four-star hotel east of Interstate 15 in over 70 years.
Wow, very interesting.
Now, let's think about that for a second. I know from reading an article that Marriott CEO says 65% of their guests are rewards members.
Really?
So if you're thinking about staying at Comic-Con downtown, and if that hotel is open, and you're coming from Phoenix or from Las Vegas or some other city, you see a rate downtown at a Marriott of perhaps $270 a night, and maybe there's a rate in El Cajon of $190 a night. They're comparable hotels. It's a 15-minute drive to downtown. It's a very natural thing to say, why not save some money and stay in El Cajon?
Makes sense, especially once they get the Performing Arts Center open again. You can take in a show right there and dinner on Main Street and, you know, have something to do right there in East County.
It's a great vision to think that we might become a hospitality hub east of the I-15.
Amazing. We should mention one other big change coming to El Cajon, and that is the redistricting. The city just went through a very extensive redistricting plan. I thought it was pretty interesting how they did it, where they actually asked the people themselves to submit maps, redraw the lines. One of our reporters tried doing it as an experiment. It's harder than you'd think to try to draw it up with all the qualifications that have to be met. But the upshot is that they approved a map with council members who will be elected by the people to represent four different districts, with the mayor elected at large still, mm-hmm. instead of everybody representing, you know, everyone. The idea, of course, is to increase the opportunities, perhaps, for minority representation. But what we've seen is there's going to be two open seats, and in the other two seats, Councilman Goble here will be squaring off against Councilman McClellan if he chooses to run again. And Councilman Colosio and Councilman Kendrick will be paired in the same districts. But the map also creates two open seat districts. So one way or the other, there's going to be at least two new faces on the council and possibly more going forward. So there's a lot of changes happening out there in El Cajon. We should mention there is possible litigation pending on that. Councilman Colosio, the Chaldean council member, has sent a letter to the city, you know, advising them of some possible litigation over that. So we'll see if that goes forward. But one way or the other, there's definitely going to be a lot more changes coming to El Cajon,
including a lot of the positive changes that Councilman Steve Goble has been talking about today.
El Cajon is just, we call it the Valley of Opportunity. And there's a lot of opportunity going on. I've told you about the hotels. I've told you about Live Nation. Our community events are designed to put more unity into the community. The car dealership, what we didn't already talk about yet, was a Jaguar Land Rover dealership has been approved for El Cajon. And that's the only second one in all of San Diego County. And that will be in here in El Cajon.
So I want to come test drive one, you know.
That would be a lot of fun to test drive those cars. And there's just a lot of good forward movement there. On the other side, we're making some, if you want to call it, addressing the needs of El Cajon with the homeless situation.
Yeah.
And I think the city has an opportunity to really take a leadership position throughout the county on trying something that really might benefit some of the most vulnerable people in society to help this problem. It's a problem being homeless. They don't want to be homeless, and the neighbors don't want homeless in their neighborhoods.
So. Right, or the business owners. So we certainly wish you well on that. You've mentioned it's a pilot project, and with luck, perhaps it'll take off, be successful, and maybe we'll see some of the other communities or the county itself or cities across the nation perhaps adopting the model for helping older homeless folks that started right here in El Cajon. Steve, you've mentioned to me before the interview that you've met with Diane Jacob, who's been a mentor to you of sorts through the years, and that she gave you some very wise advice. Can you tell us what that is and how that's influenced your outlook on what a politician should really be all about?
You know, she gave me two good things of advice. I know there's many more, but two that I can recall right now. Listen, learn, and lead. And it's a very important in that order to really listen to all the stakeholders about something. And then you learn a lot of things just by listening that maybe you didn't know before. Once you've learned things, now it's time to lead.
Yeah, she certainly has been, I think it's a safe statement to say that she's done more outreach than any politician I've ever seen in my 30-some years of covering them. Just about every week she's got a coffee with the community somewhere, and she has an absolutely enormous district with the entire unincorporated, almost all of the unincorporated area out here, and yet she seems to get to every single rural town and listen to anybody that wants to come meet their elected official. Whether you agree with her or not on her policies, she listens and she meets people.
That's true. A good public servant, more so than a politician, but a good public servant like Diane listens to people because it's about a relationship. And the more accessible that you are, the more that you are willing to listen. We don't have to necessarily agree or end up at the same place, but at least to respect your voice, your opinion, that's very valuable in truly serving the public.
Yeah, I think so. I think in these divisive times we're in, we see too many politicians that don't heed that advice, that seem to think they can be sort of sheltered from the public and that it's really an annoyance if they actually have to show up at something like a town hall or a public forum and talk about and defend their policies. And sometimes it seems like they're talking at people instead of listening to people.
That's true, because at the end of the day, it's really not about me. It's about the people. So as Diane also told me, the more that you make it about the people, the better that your policies and your governing will be. It's not about what I think. It's about after listening to people, after learning to people, getting that consensus, like I talked about on the homeless coalition.
Yeah.
This isn't my plan. This is just something that developed almost for people clamoring for this kind of help.
Yeah, it's really an issue that transcends party lines, and I think that philosophy, if everybody in every party would follow that, we'd be a lot better off as a society.
I think so, too. It just kind of dials everything down. We have a more productive discussion, maybe a little less emotion. There needs to be time for emotion in discussion, but certainly to have a productive discussion helps, too.
Okay. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Steve Goble, the newly elected councilman in the city of El Cajon. Steve, I really want to thank you for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam. It's been my pleasure.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Brian Boykel, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.